Hey there, everyone. Thanks for listening to Limited Engagement. I'm your host for the show, Jared Duran. My guest for this episode is Sam Walker. We'll get to that in a minute. It's, been about a month, if not exactly a month, since the last time I did one of these. And, I realized that that last intro was a little cryptic, but a lot of stuff has happened, and I am probably not going to catch you up on all of it, which I'll also get to in a sec. I do want to knock out real quick our, before I forget, not because I don't want to, but our sponsor, Phoenix Film Collective, is putting on a screening of Bong Joon-ho's The Host, which, if you are not aware, he's the director behind the Academy Award-winning Parasite. He won for Best Director, and the film won for Best Picture. And the screening is taking place at the Third Street Theater at Phoenix Center for the Arts on Sunday, March 22nd at 2 p.m. So that's a nice Sunday afternoon showing, and you can learn more information on this screening and other things about the Phoenix Film Collective by going to phxfilmcollective.com. Again, that's phxfilmcollective.com. And I might as well get, since I'm talking about Phoenix Film Collective, I might as well mention something that I'm doing for them, along with my friend and What the Fork co-host Jason Kyle. We're going to be doing the second installment, I don't know what you want to call it, edition of the film discussion series that the Phoenix Film Collective started. And at the end of January, they did one with for Wim Wenders, specifically discussing Wings of Desire and Paris, Texas. And Jason and I are going to do the next one on March 31st. It's going to be over at First Draft, which is that bar that's attached to the Phoenix Changing Hands location in the Newton Shopping Center on March 31st. I think that is at 7 o'clock, possibly 7:30. I could do a better job of plugging this if I knew what time it was, but it's definitely March 31st, and you can find more information on that by finding the Facebook event, I think. I don't see that they've put it up on their website yet, but I would imagine that they will soon. That's a free event. We're going to moderate a discussion about philosophy and film, specifically from different, or how do I want to say this? So there are a couple of films that very much head on take on philosophical themes, and those are Richard Linklater's Waking Life, and what's the other one we just discussed? It I Heart Huckabees by David O. Russell, and so we're going to talk about how they approach things differently and presented them, and they're two of my favorite films. Although I think Waking Life probably edges out I Heart Huckabees for me, but we'll see. I hadn't seen I Heart Huckabees in probably about 10 years or so, maybe longer. And then, on What the Fork, as we do during our hiatus periods, we discuss a film that we feel like has had some impact on or connection to, or, similarities and themes to The Good Place. For this period, we talked about I Heart Huckabees. That's kind of how this all sort of came about. But anyway, again, March 22nd. Nope. Jesus. That's the Phoenix Film Collective showing. March 31st at First Draft. Film discussion. I Heart Huckabees. Waking Life. David O. Russell, Richard Linklater, philosophy, film. Those are all the bullet points. You can check that out and maybe come and hang and talk some film with us. So as I mentioned, I'm not gonna, you know, go through all the stuff that I've been going through over the last month. It was a break that I needed. So I took it. I sort of cryptically relayed the information that had been dumped yet again, and took that particularly hard. I did some didn't handle it particularly well. Got myself pretty good and drunk, and did like a whole. Thought it was a great idea to do like a high fidelity contact my exes and try to get them to tell me what's wrong with me and why I'm doomed to be alone, sort of thing. It was horribly misguided, and it didn't go well at all, as you can probably imagine. And it actually led me to completely quit drinking for about a month, very close to a month, and try to process some things. And so that's what I did. That's what I took the time to do. And one of the things that I was processing was what I, how much of myself I put out there in these intros. Because it really, I sit here and I record these things, and I don't plan to, I don't really know what I'm going to talk about. And so I just talk about whatever's in my head. And, as somebody who could probably very much benefit from some therapy, and I have in short periods of time, I've used this as a platform to kind of work out some of those things. And I don't know that that's been the healthiest thing for me. And I also don't really think about who's going to listen to it. Basically anybody who kind of wants to know about the shit that's going through my head and how I deal or don't deal with things, could basically just listen to the 5 years worth of intros that I've done to this show. And it, like drinking as a coping mechanism, this is another crutch that I've had. And I don't know how healthy it's been for me. And it's also sort of it has removed a sort of another layer of privacy, because it makes me it lays my problems out there for people, and I have always approached this as kind of a maybe me working through some things on mic is helps other people, or can be a sort of I don't know what it is. And so I kind of have to rethink that too. So I'm not going to go into all the things that I've kind of been working on. I instead turned to writing, which is, which made me realize actually how little I have done that. It always had been how I process things through poetry, through lyrics, through stories. And I haven't been doing that for some time. I've essentially having to go through submissions for Hoot and Waddle, and before that, for Chambers Press. I haven't really been focusing on my own writing, over this month, I've done a lot of it. In a way that helped me process things, because some of the writing to a project or writing, or the freelance work that I've taken on lately, it doesn't serve the same purpose. It's very much, I'm responding to a piece of artwork, or I'm responding, or I'm writing a specific, you know, telling somebody else's story or that kind of thing. So, or doing a review or whatever. And it's great. I love writing. And so any writing, anytime I get to do that is great. But it had lost a lot of what I got out of it to begin with and why it has been so important to me. So I don't know. There are many more of these to come, and I'm sure I'll work out some of that here still. But I just, you know, I have to take some time periodically and just actually process things rather than avoid them. And doing this, I think, is actually also a little bit of avoidance, because it's, I mean, in as much as this is me, it's still me on mic, and it's not, you know, there's still some element you can't take away. I don't know how to explain that. This is podcast host Jared, which is still not the same as me just kind of being, this is going to get super fucking esoteric and whatnot, but me being with my own thoughts and just making myself work through them and face them and work shit out just by myself. There's an unseen audience, and that's still, as much as it's, you know, doing this in this format removes the effect that being, you know, talking in front of other people, you know, has on filtering and all that sort of thing. It's still filtered. I don't know. We'll drop that there and talk about my guest for this episode, who, as I mentioned, is Sam Walker. She has a podcast that is, called Sam Walker's Desert Diaries. You can get it on all the major platforms. It's these bite-sized, you know, just like weekly encapsulations of her move from England to Phoenix and the sort of adjustment that is causing, and it's a delight to listen to, and I highly suggest you check that out. And you can hear all about it in this conversation right now. It was that I was such an enormous fan of the book and then the film that, you know, I've heard good things about it, but it's still, I don't know. It's one of those things where, why did they need to remake it?
Why? No, that's exactly my thought. I've heard good things, and I just went, but still, why? There was no need. Mm-hmm. There was no need. And it's nothing against her. I think she's great. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I was just, what?
I think the argument that people are putting out there right now actually is, is that the film kind of highlighted, you know, toxic masculinity. And so this is supposed to, I don't know, combat that. I don't know how you combat toxic masculinity.
Quite a long time ago as well. It's not that every woman has been saying, well, that film needs an answering. Because it was like quite a long time ago.
It was about 20 years ago at this point. Yeah,
it was.
Yeah. Okay. When, I don't know, John Cusack still had a full head of hair. And it's
yeah.
But it's a little weird because now I feel like I know quite a bit about you already. Because this morning, I'm completely caught up on all of, 41 weeks, 42 weeks?
Oh, really? Well, tomorrow is the final episode the backstory, and then everyone's got to wait, and then it's going to be weekly. So it feels
okay.
Yeah, that's a strange thing. I mean, having been a radio presenter for so many years, it would be strange. I would even like call my mother sometimes and say, "Hey, Mum, guess what happened yesterday?" And she went, "Oh, you went and got your navel pierced." And I'm like, "How do you know?" She went, "Because I listened to your radio show." And I was like, "Oh yes." And I kind of forget that. People know things about me that I forgot I said anything about.
Because the intro to this podcast is just I don't know, whatever's on my mind for a few minutes, and it has become, it's been about 5 years that I've been doing it, and it's a little disconcerting to have somebody that I really know nothing about have know exactly all the existential angst I've been going through about the last breakup I had. I'd like to get into that eventually, but we got to start somewhere. So, for those who have not yet listened to the podcast of Sam Walker's Desert Stories?
Desert Diaries.
Diaries. Okay, which makes sense, which is why it's in this weekly format thing. Can you give a little bit of a backstory as to how you made why did you make the journey out here and settle into this vastly different climate and space?
I suppose there's two answers to that. There's two sort of story arcs. One is really super positive, and it's about having a crazy dream and realizing that you just have one life and there's never going to be the perfect time to do the thing you've always dreamt about doing. So you might as well just go and do it and embrace change and just put both feet into a brand new life. And the other one, I suppose, is a bit more thoughtful, which is, holy shit, you've got one life. And without getting too deep and dark about everything, you know, my family went through quite a difficult time with losing family members, my husband's father, my uncle, who I was very close to, various other family members. We lost a lot within about a year. And when you lose people close to you over such a kind of quick succession, it really starts to make you think, whoa, life really is short and we do only get one life. A good friend of mine who was just 40 then died after contracting breast cancer. She had a three-year-old son. I worked with her, Rachel Bland, incredible woman who did a podcast called You, Me and the Big C, in which she kind of really broke down the barriers about cancer. And then an even closer friend of mine, an amazing, amazing woman called Diane Oxbury, who was just the most vivacious individual you would ever meet. She was just one of these people who would walk into a room, and I know it's a cliche, but the room would light up and people would be drawn to her, and she had this incredible energy. And she worked on TV as a weathercaster, and she was fantastic. And she got sick and was diagnosed with ovarian cancer on Christmas Eve in 2017 and died 5 days later, leaving two young children. And again, I don't want to get deep and dark because these aren't unique stories. Mm-hmm. These happen all the time, everywhere, to virtually every family. But they really affected me. And I'd had this dream and, you know, I'd crazy dream of just quitting everything and going and living somewhere nothing like where I was living at the time, which was Manchester in England. Mm-hmm. And I suppose it was almost like the planets aligned, and it was just like a big booming voice going, just go and do it. Go and do it. What, you know, what's the worst that can happen? And the answer is quite a lot. but at the same time, there's nothing like a bit of drama to make you feel alive. And I wanted to make sure that I was living, because I think we can whip by. I mean, I'm in my mid-40s now, and I remember 18 like yesterday, and it's, again, sounds like a crazy cliche, but cliches are there for a reason, because they're true.
Well, it's interesting. I don't think that I can remember yesterday like it was yesterday, but you know, like 20 years ago, I've got a pretty good memory for, so I, you know, hopefully that'll hold for a while. But I think that, I don't know. I've always been hyper aware of how old I am, to the point where I'm always, you know, telling people that I'm like a year older than I am. and it's this, you know, I've known people recently who have lost their parents and lost, you know, and you know, or they've themselves, you know, have gotten have had to tackle some health things, and it's taught me a couple of things. One is that if you don't go to the doctor, you may be have a higher likelihood of not getting sick, and then, that it's absolutely true. We only have so much time, and it's kind of, you have to decide what's important to you and what you can just kind of let go as well. And that, you know, to sort of just brave your way into things. It's interesting that, you know, for me, this probably just started happening when I hit my mid-30s of deciding to just, you know, put aside whatever trepidation about things that I might have and stop listening to the voice that says, no, you can't do this. You better not do this. Yeah. And just be like, why the fuck not?
This is what people do, right? This is what you should do. You should work this long and you should save for retirement and you shouldn't go on that crazy adventure. Why? Right. Who wrote these rules? Because I don't know anyone who actually wrote these rules, but we all seem to collectively shuffle along and adhere to them. And once you take a little step outside, guess what? There's a whole bunch of people just over there who don't follow any of those rules, and they're doing really okay.
Right. No, it's this whole ingrained thing of this like, I don't know, puritanical kind of thing of you. You know, you go through school, you better go to college so you can earn a good living. You find somebody, you settle down, you have kids together, you get old, and then you die. You know, it's...
And you might have a few years at the end when all the hard work you've done, you've got some money to go on trips and experience life.
If you're lucky, right?
If you're lucky! This is the crazy thing that we all presume that, you know, oh, well, I can save that to retirement. I'll go on that trip to Europe in retirement. I'll go and buy that RV or do something crazy in retirement. And guess what? You might not be lucky enough to have that. You know?
Exactly. Yeah. Who can actually afford to retire anymore? And they keep pushing back that age before you can get, you know, around here, Social Security. And also, you know, I know so many people at this point who've ventured back into the workforce because they don't know what to do without a profession at that point.
Yeah.
I don't know how we got off on that topic other than just to, you know,
this is what happens.
Yeah. It is what happens. Absolutely. So what, but let's go back even further now and let's go back to what interested you in getting into broadcasting?
Wow. Well, I was the kid who would make radio shows in her bedroom with the old cassette tape players where you had to press record and play.
Yeah.
And I would record radio shows the whole time. And I was the annoying kid that if my mum and dad, I was an only child, so I had a lot of time on my own in my room with that, you know, cassette player. I'd write a play and go down in the middle of dinner, go, da-da, you know, and put the play on, and everyone would politely clap and say, right, go away now. And so I suppose I always loved doing that, but never thought I could ever do anything in the creative industry, because who would want to listen to me? I'm just some kid. And even when I was sort of 18, 19, 20. So I studied hard. I did the thing of working really hard, and I was allowed out 2 nights a week. And, you know, on a Saturday night and on a Wednesday night, and the rest of the time I studied, and I got into a really good university, and I worked really, really hard, and I got a degree, and I kind of went, now what do I do? And I was like, okay, journalism, I've always been interested in writing. And again, I kind of went on that cookie cutter route and got some work experience at a newspaper, and fell into, for an entire decade, doing a bit of writing, bit of marketing, bit of PR, but not doing it with purpose. I really respect people who do all those things really well and love it, but I wasn't doing it. I was doing it because I didn't know what else to do, because I'd always had a dream of kind of standing up on a stage or being behind a microphone or doing something, but genuinely didn't know how to get into it. My family were, you know, a working class family. We didn't have any connections in the world of media. I had no idea how to get into it at all. And so I just bumbled through. And it was only really when I was running, I was working as a temp in London, like a secretary. I joined a temp agency, and they called up one day and said, oh, some company need you to go and sit on the front desk and answer phones for the day. And I was like, I can do that. This is with the really big degree that I worked for years to get. I was answering phones and, you know, for whatever dollars a day it was. And it was a radio company. But they did in-store radio.
Okay.
So they were, when you walk into the store and they go, afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, this afternoon you will find 10 pounds of ladies' tights in the underwear section. Here's status quo. So I would program, you know, so again, but I thought this was amazingly exciting because there was a studio and a microphone. I didn't care that it was quite famous radio presenters coming in and getting paid a few hundred pounds to record these sort of liners, which I would then program and edit and put in into phones, because I kind of talked my way into a job there from answering the phone. And so I just thought this was incredibly exciting. And again, still, I did nothing about ever being on the radio. I just loved being around all the equipment and the microphones. And fast forward a few years, and I was sort of, by a couple of jobs along the line, was running a recording studio. And again, I was the person who would come in and set everything up. And it was kind of a, I suppose, a kind of an administrative role again. But some guy who I'd met, who was a DJ, a club DJ, had then started working for a teeny tiny little radio station in South London. And he called me up and he said, look, I remember, you've got a really good voice. He said, you've got a good voice. And you studied journalism, right? And I was like, yeah, I did an English degree and then I did a postgrad thing in journalism. And he was like, I need newsreaders. Why don't you come to my station and just kind of do a little bit of news reading for me? Hmm. And again, I was literally, to coin a British race, faffing around for my entire 20s. So I didn't know what I was doing at all. So I was like, yeah, okay. So I went in and he was on air and he was presenting a drive time program and it was music and chat and kind of one of those kind of hit music stations. And he said, look, while you're here, here's some paper, read the travel report. And as I looked at the screen or the piece of paper to read the travel report, and the red light went on, and literally I had the moment where metaphorical heavens opened and angels came down with harps going, this is what you want to do. This is it. And I thought, oh, the relief. And I went, this is what I want to do. Because I didn't know for 10 years what I wanted to do. And I remember the red light went off again after the the recording. And I just went, this is what I want to do. And I literally found this confidence that I hadn't ever had in my entire life. Mm. And I walked into the boss's office there and I went, you got to put me on the radio. I want to be on the radio. And he was like, well, have you any experience of being on the radio? And I went, no, but I want to do it. And I know I'll be really good at it. And I talked my way into a job. And that was in 2000, I think. And the rest is history. But, you know, I worked damn hard, and I worked in the middle of the night, and I worked for no money, and I worked for really poor money and all the rest of it. But I just loved it. I loved it. And I got up at stupid o'clock and drove across London because I couldn't afford to live anywhere near where the radio station was. And, you know, but it was a palpable sense of relief that I'd found something that I really, really wanted to do. And yeah, I loved it.
So, cut to now, and you're not on the radio. So how was that to leave that?
It was weird. I did love being on air. I miss being on air, but I was getting in a car. I mean, I ended up being on national radio and the BBC, and also local BBC radio in Manchester. So BBC Radio Manchester, BBC Radio 5 Live, which is a big national, very fast moving news sports station, breaking news, features, all speech. And I worked so hard to get there, and I was really desperate to get there. I really wanted to show that I could do it from someone who didn't know what they wanted to do and didn't believe I could ever have a career in the media. I was like, I want to get there. I want to get up to that top of that mountain, I suppose. And I did it, and I loved it, and it was a complete thrill and amazing. And then a couple of years ago, I woke up one day and went, right, what's happening today? Oh, I'm interviewing Meatloaf and Roger Moore this week. And I remember doing what you did and just going, what? What? And it really shocked me that I saw that as a chore when it was, what the? I mean, my God, how incredible to interview those people. Mm-hmm. I was like, what am I, what? And it took me a while to really think, oh, I'd lost that passion a bit because I'd done it for 6 or 7 days a week for 10 years.
Sure.
And I was tired. And I suppose, I don't know, it's hard to put my finger on it, but I'd got to the point where I thought, I've worked that hard. I've got there. Now what? Mm-hmm. Now what? And as I said, I still miss the kind of day-to-day of it. And I miss talking to people like Roger Moore and Meatloaf. It was amazing. But I just have this feeling that there's something else out there now. There's something else I want to try, and there's people I want to meet and places I want to see. And I am living in a wonderful house in a great city, and I've got loads of fantastic friends, but I'm getting in a car and I'm driving to a studio and I'm coming home again every day. Mm-hmm. And you might think I'm an idiot because, you know, I was well paid and it was, I mean, I don't know, I could have lost my job the next day. I don't know. Obviously, I decided to quit, but I just thought, if I don't take a chance, I'm always going to think, what if, what mm-hmm. if, what if, what if? And, you know, I just wanted to explore. I just had that itch that just wouldn't go away. And, mm-hmm. you know, it took me 3 years maybe to actually properly do anything about it, but it was constantly there. And it was got to the point where I was just miserable because I just wanted to try something else.
When you can't get excited about interviewing Roger Moore anymore.
What a dick. I mean, I'm so aware. I really am super aware how stupid that sounds. I really am.
Well, I suppose you get jaded after a while. I mean, I've you know, talked to a few, mostly musical heroes, I guess. But I, you know, even that's still after doing this for 5 years, it's I keep running into, okay, how much longer do I want to sit around and talk to people for, you know, how many different conversations can I have? And, you know, I don't know. Luckily, I'm still enjoying some aspect of it enough, but I can see certainly. But I have to ask, because Roger Moore is still my favorite James Bond.
Amazing.
So do you have a Roger Moore story, though? I mean, like, what was it like to actually talk to him?
Just fabulous. I've got the most brilliant picture of the two of us together. But I do remember him. I mean, you will remember the details of this better than I, because he was talking about one of his films, and I was just asking him about working with some of the people he worked with. Mm-hmm. And it was not long before he died that I interviewed him, and he was a very elderly man by this stage, and he was going off on tour, and he was telling me really honestly, he was like, I forget sometimes what I'm talking about. I can be on stage and I will forget, and I have a man who sits with me, who's kind of interviewing me, and he just has to prompt me the whole time because he knows all the stories, he said. And I will give him like keywords and he will prompt me, because I would have forgotten my train of thought. And he was just beautifully honest about it, because he was an older guy. Mm-hmm. But we were talking about, you know, becoming Bond and everything. And I was saying about some of the women he'd worked with. And was it him with Ursula Andress, or was that Sean Connery?
I think it was Sean Connery.
I can't remember. He was talking about some leading lady. Mm-hmm. That he'd worked with, and he said, and he spoke very slowly at this time, you know, because he was an older guy, and he spoke very precisely, and he said, oh, I do remember, though, from the moment I met her, she walked into the room, and, you know, there was just this frisson between us. A bit like the frisson that's here now, Sam, between you and I. And I was like, James Bond is flirting with me. And it was just, but he said it, he wasn't being sleazy or cheap. He, sure. You know, he had this amazing twinkle in his eye, and he knew that he was just being a character. And it was just hilarious. And I just burst out laughing. It was just brilliant, brilliant, brilliant. But he was great. And of course I loved doing it once I did it, but it takes a lot of work to prepare for an interview with someone of that caliber. You don't just sit down and go, chat, chat, chat. Of course, you want to serve your audience and you want to respect them by having done as much work as you can. So I think it was just kind of the relentlessness of it all that I just got really, really tired.
That's pretty funny. I, you know what, to be honest, other than listening to your podcast, I did no research whatsoever. And that's pretty typical for me. I turn these things on and I just have the conversation. But, I have kind of eschewed the idea of doing any deep research on anybody. But when you're, especially,
that sometimes makes the best interviews.
I've found so, but it's also, it's much different. These are long form conversations. For you, I would imagine you just had a few minutes to get somebody in and out, right? Well, or did you get to have some of those?
You had
longer?
Some time, so it was about 40 minutes.
Okay,
so it was
that's decent.
It was a good amount of time, and I think, social media and the text console for a national radio station, mm-hmm. can be brutal places. And you're interviewing someone's hero,
right?
And you get something wrong, or you don't talk about X, Y, or Z about their life that this super fan of theirs who's listening wanted to know about. Mm-hmm. They're going to tell you.
Yeah.
And I found that really tough to deal with, really tough to deal with, that I would interview somebody and perhaps there was a couple of times when interviews didn't go quite so well. I was lucky only a couple of times, but I mean, all my interviews weren't great by any means. I'm a human being. I got things wrong or whatever. But wow, there were a couple of times when things kind of took a turn and perhaps the person I was interviewing didn't really understand what I was asking them or didn't like what I was asking them. Their fan base come for you.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
And they come for you when you're at home making your children's dinner mm-hmm. and your phone is kind of blowing up and you can, you know, and your social media is going crazy. And once one of the fans knows what, you know, it's just, and I just thought, I didn't sign up for this. I'm just trying to do a job. And
right.
that, you know, that's something that I think a lot of, I mean, people are talking about it more now, but a few years ago, mm-hmm. there were just shrugs of, oh, well. Just ignore it.
Yeah, well, and it was just kind of nice to hear somebody that you admired be, you know, interviewed or something. I don't, yeah. It's interesting because this is just a very small microcosm of that, but I it'll end up coming back at some point. But I was doing this podcast called Album Infinitum, where I would have go through an entire artist's catalog and I would have different guests on each episode and there would be varying degrees of they were fans and or had never heard them before and had just heard the album for the first time and we would just sit down and talk about the album and I did like Amy Mann and Squeeze and Galaxy 500 and
Galaxy 500 are very important. My daughter is called Britta after Britta Phillips from Luna, so there you go. That's
Dean Wareham. I have his Black Postcards book behind you there. But there are certain I got the most like people for both Squeeze and for Galaxy 500 of people being like, you know, I love what you're doing talking about this. This is great to hear about music that I'm passionate about to you have no idea what you're talking about with this album and your opinions are it's just two people talking just opinions talking. About music and it's crazy. It's on the one hand it's like, oh, okay, people are listening, but also can you just respectfully disagree.
Exactly that. And you're not being mean, you're not spreading hate, you're just saying, oh, I think that it's difficult. It's horrible, actually.
Yeah, it is. So all right, you just happened to mention Meatloaf and Roger Moore at the sort of tail end of your radio interviewing career, but along the way, who were you most excited to that you got to talk to?
Ricky Gervais.
Oh, okay.
I loved Ricky Gervais. My very first interview on national radio was Emma Thompson.
Mm.
I was terrified.
Wow.
I was absolutely terrified. I mean, this is the thing as well. I suppose everyone thinks that anyone who's behind a mic is super confident and knows exactly what they're doing. And as I said, you know, I kind of stumbled into the media. Well, I'd always kind of, as I said, from the days of pressing record play on a tape deck, had something I'd wanted to do, but you know, my folks, as I said, my mum worked in an office. My dad was a high school teacher. We didn't know anything about the media. It was just so a million miles. I grew up in a tiny town in the Midlands in England. No media was nothing in my family at all. So the fact I even got into it was just like, I still don't quite know how it happened. But so Emma Thompson was the first opportunity I got. And I remember, the first show I did on 5 Live that was the afternoon show. I'd done a couple of news shows that was more of a sort of short form interviews about the news. So it was like a 90 minute show that I'd done. And it was very much, let's speak to this person about some flooding that has happened here, you know, kind of important news stuff. But the first kind of big afternoon primetime show that I covered because the presenter was away, I remember there was this kind of this roundup music that would come. So the previous show would go, and thanks very much. And next up on 5 Live, it's Sam Walker. And then it'd be like, doo, 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 doo. And I'd be sitting there waiting for the doo when I would then come in and speak. And I was sitting there and I was shaking so much in front of the microphone. I could hear in my headphones because I was so frightened. And then just as the music went, doo, doo, and I knew I had to start talking, I looked down and I'd written without realizing it on a piece of paper, shit. And then I kind of went, I'm back, I'm talking. And it was Emma Thompson that day. And I was so scared of getting it wrong. But I'd done so much. It'd taken me hours and hours of research to do this interview. And it was great, actually, because I'd kind of dug up some stories about her that she'd kind of forgotten about. So it was brilliant to hear her complete joy. There was one story I must just tell you about when she loved Scotland. Mm-hmm. And she's really passionate about Scotland. And she would drive from London up to Scotland to this little cottage they had in the middle of nowhere. And she said how she would walk sort of half a mile from her back door of this little cottage down to this stream through all these fields, and there was nobody around, and literally no one. And so she walked down one day and took a dip in the river. And it was a beautiful summer's day and it was quite warm. So she walked back naked because there's no one around. And, sure. You know, it was her property and she was walking back through all this kind of fields and la, la, la.
And if you're Emma Thompson, why not?
If you're Emma Thompson, why not? Sure. So she got home and there was a knock at the door a couple of hours later and it was a police officer. And she's like, oh, hello. And he said, I'm really sorry to disturb you, but I don't want to alarm you. But I know that, you know, you're not here all the time and you are visiting this weekend. He said, we have had some reports that... a couple of people who were out walking saw a naked elderly man walking through your fields a couple of hours ago.
Oh, boy.
She was like, that was me.
That is awful.
And I'd actually totally forgotten about that whole thing. And so, you know, there was some great fun stuff in it. And then I remember at the end, she said, oh, I really enjoyed that. You were a really wonderful interviewer. And I thought, what? Am I? Whoa. And I lived off that for years, to be honest, because I just couldn't believe that I'd done something that someone who I really admired thought was quite good. And I'm sure everyone at home probably thought, oh, pompous ass. And I was just going, wah, you know. So yeah, I really enjoyed Ricky Gervais. I just loved. So again, I really enjoyed that. Do you know the ones, and it's going to sound like I'm making this up, but I am not. I really enjoyed Regular People.
Okay.
Who had just done something a little bit outside their comfort zone, or done something they were proud of, or just fantastic stories of kind of redemption or great spirit or love, or and they're the ones that really left me feeling good. I mean, celebrities, you know, I think people don't realize how hard celebrities work to be really good at what they do and how much they give up. But it's not boo-hoo them because they're all sitting around in, you know, with a great lifestyle, but it is really tough. And so I do, you know, there are people I really, really admired, but there was one lady once who came in. I was on local radio at the time, BBC Local Radio, BBC Radio Manchester, and we were doing a piece that was like National Volunteering Week. Mm-hmm. And this lady came in and she was in her late 80s and she volunteered 3 times a week. With old people, as she put it, which was wonderful. She went, I go and visit the old people because they get a bit lonely. And I was like, you're amazing. And I had this great interview with her and she'd come in. I was like, I'm Sam, great to meet you. And we were in a full-blown radio studio. I hadn't gone to her house. She was in the studio with me. And we had this whole interview and I was like, it's National Volunteering Week, BBC Radio Manchester. I'm Sam Walker. I'm here talking to Vera about her volunteering. So, you know, you do this. This is great. What does it give to you? Why do you love it? La, la, la. Good 10-minute interview. And at the end, I went, Vera, thank you so very much. Brilliant stuff. Right, coming up next on BBC Radio Manchester, we've got all the latest travel news. Let's find out what's happening on the roads. Press a button, the fader comes down. I said, oh, thank you, Vera, so much. That was so kind. She went, what was your name again? And I said, it's Sam. And she said, oh, right. I said, Sam Walker. She went, oh, there's a girl called Sam Walker on the radio. And I was like...
Right there.
No, I just thought, you're amazing. You have just sat through a 10-minute interview in a radio studio. And you went, oh, there's a guy on Sam Rock on the radio. And I went, I'm her. Because we're on the radio. Right? And it was such pure joy from her that that just made me so happy.
I thought she was hysterical. Great. Hysterical. That's great. Well, I think it's interesting, you know, that I don't know, there seems to be... I never thought I was going to be good at interviewing people necessarily because, you know, I'm not just out in public, just with people, you know, I'm not necessarily a great conversationalist unless I've had a few drinks. So it's, but for some reason I have a microphone and suddenly some ability to talk. But there's also this concern just initially anyway, until you find kind of some, you know, vein of thought to mine or something, where am I going to be able to connect in a way that's interesting? Not even just to the people that are listening, but to me in order to keep going on and talking to people. So, I mean, to do that, you know, and this is just, you know, when I'm on my booking game, it's just a weekly gig, but, you know, to do that, you know, every, you know, for your 9 to 5, basically, That had to take a toll after a while.
Yeah, and sometimes you don't find the groove, and sometimes you don't find the vein. And some people, like, you could sit next to anyone in a pub or in a party or in whatever you're doing, And sometimes you connect and gel with people and you find instantly that kind of frisson, as Roger Moore would say, where you kind of connect and you've got commonality and all the rest of it. And other people, you'd be like, right, so do you like sport? No, not really. Okay. Do you like music? No, not really. And you just think, okay. And then I don't know about you, but I always go away from encounters like that thinking, what's wrong with me? Why can't I have that? Why couldn't I connect with that person? What's wrong with me? Sometimes you just don't connect with people. And when you're unfortunately on air and like 5 million people are listening, right. And then they all want to tell you that you didn't do that very good job of that afterwards, it can be tough.
Sometimes too, it's that somebody doesn't give you much to work with. They're right, very clipped. They're not giving you anything to kind of expound on. You don't connect. And sometimes too, and the microphone can be intimidating for somebody. I'll have a lovely conversation with somebody and then hit record and it's just, two word answers for a while. And like, we were just pretend it's not there. Pretend this whole thing wasn't, it was like it was 5 minutes ago. But I used to do this show. I started out doing this show live, and one of the reasons that I don't anymore is because people were so conscious of the audience that they were, trying to entertain in some way, or trying to be interesting, or being very, maybe even guarded about what they would say because there's a room full of people. To kind of remove that and have it just be this sort of one-on-one. And the fact that I never have a piece of paper in front of me or anything like that, it's just, I think it tends to allow for somebody to be a little more candid, I guess. But, I think that is something that's relatively new in the podcasting form too, though, because even if you are having that conversation on radio, you're typically in a studio and there's all this equipment around and you know that it's going out on air. At least here, there's some disconnect between you and I talking here and then me throwing it out, for hopefully somebody to download and listen to.
My mum will do it. It's fine. I'll let her know. Yeah.
Perfect. So we've got two, your mom and maybe my mom. No. All right. Had you done much in the way of podcasting prior to moving here?
I had.
Okay.
I had. I'd done a fair bit. When I was still at the BBC working 6 days a week, I actually talk about kind of hearing from regular people about extraordinary things that they've done. And I really, really wanted to do a series of longer form interviews, not really long, but like 20 to 40 minutes about people who had found themselves in a place of their life where they felt stuck. Because I think we've all had times in our lives where we kind of go, how did I get here? Mm-hmm. I never imagined I would be here. How has this happened? Like you suddenly go, I'm 40. How has this happened? And that kind of crazy thing. I remember a friend of mine walking in to her sort of sitting room on her birthday and just seeing all the cards saying happy 40th and going, who is that? And I was like, it's me. God, how did this happen? But not just about age, but about, perhaps taking a wrong turn in life. And I mean, this was, 5 years ago, I had this idea to do this. And I'd gone and talked to one of my bosses at the BBC about it. And they were like, it's not for us. And I was like, we could do it as a podcast. And they were like, we don't really do podcasts, genuinely. No one had done it. So I thought, I know, the BBC, that were quite slow in the whole podcast revolution. They didn't do them. Or maybe they'd record a bit of the radio show and put that out as a podcast. And I'm like, that's not really a podcast because it's kind of not. But anyway, no one was interested. And I just thought, okay, I'm just going to do it. And ridiculously, I had two children, was working 6 days a week. I bought this completely falling down house that we were kind of doing up in our spare time, haha. And I just thought, but it was that purpose thing. I thought, I really want to do this. Mm-hmm. And I'm not very woo-woo and I asked the universe and it all came. But I tell you what, as soon as I decided I was going to do it, I just came across all these amazing stories. I went, there we go, I'm just going to do it. So the first person I interviewed with like a little handheld digital recorder in a closet in my house because I thought coats good for sound, because I'd been in audio my whole life, but I'd always been in a studio or on an outside broadcast or something. So and I interviewed this amazing woman who I should make you listen to the podcast. It's called What Goes On Here. And essentially, lots of podcasts have followed it that are completely the same premise, but I didn't do very well in marketing it or telling anyone about it. But I was incredibly lucky that I made 6 episodes and Audible heard it and said, we love it. Can we commission it? So I was so lucky because there are so many podcasts out there. Yeah. So they then commissioned 3 more seasons. So I had 4 seasons of it and they were just so many stories. Two seasons or maybe three, I can't remember, are now out of, because I had to license to them for a couple of years. Mm-hmm. And then once that licensing agreement was up, they've still got it on their platform, but they let me then put it out wherever. So what goes on here is stories of people who just, yeah, kind of found themselves in a life they didn't imagine would be theirs and what happened. So I loved making that in a kind of crazy connected universe type way. Doing that podcast is really why I'm here now.
Mm.
Because so many people I met and interviewed, it was basically free therapy is what I'm saying. I met people who had just taken massively bold steps in their lives and gone, this isn't the life I kind of want anymore. I'm going to step outside it. And we've all seen bloody posters, haven't we, everywhere? Fear the fear and do it anyway. And
right.
Follow your dreams. And we all go, yeah, I'm going to follow my dreams. And then who does it? Nobody, virtually. We all go,
right.
When I'm retired, maybe I'll get that electric guitar or
sure.
Go on that trip to wherever. And I'm aware that stuff costs money and it's hard to do things that are expensive, but also you just bloody do it, you know?
Right.
So in fact, a lot of the people I met during making that podcast series, I realized when I came to make this crazy decision to do this, I was like, oh yeah, I'm just going to do it. Yeah. So I made What Goes On Here. And then I started making a few podcasts. Well, I made a podcast for a local women's organization. I say local, it's kind of local to England. Mm-hmm. Northern Power Women podcast, which is like a women in business podcast. And then I made a podcast. So I've made quite a lot is the short answer to your question.
So you're saying you've done a couple.
I've done a few. And I make about five or six now for various organizations and things. So I've kind of become a real audio geek and I love it.
Do you feel like that helps, you know, negate some of the missing being out of broadcasting?
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, that's one of the reasons why I made Desert Diaries as well, is because obviously being on radio in the UK for quite a long time, again, I didn't even think about it. I didn't mm-hmm. think, I must make a series. Everyone's desperate to know what I'm doing with my life. But a friend who was still on radio in Manchester said, well, just do me a couple of minutes a week, because your listeners, you've been for 16 years talking to, kind of want to know what's going on in your life. Mm. And I was like, I'll do that. So I would write and record a much longer bit, mm-hmm. but then send him a couple of minutes. So it meant that from the day we got here, the day after we made this move and gave our life up and moved to the desert, I was recording in real time and I had all that archive there. And I am so thankful that he suggested it, because I genuinely don't think I would have actually got that. And I said to my friend, I don't know what to do with all this now. And he said, but it doesn't really matter what you do with it. You've got the most incredible personal family archive, you know. And what's bizarre is my 12-year-old daughter loves it.
Huh.
And we get in the car and she goes, put it on. I'm like, this is just your life. This is what was happening last week. But she loves it. And my 12-year-old doesn't like anything that I do because she's 12.
Well, yeah.
12, and I suck, you know, so I get that. So I'm like, wow, she cares about it. So, I put it out there and I just thought, well, I have no idea whether anyone's going to like it.
Mm-hmm.
But then people have, which is really, really nice. So
it's interesting. It's interesting what we kind of find or what triggers us to do something. And you know, people who've been listening to this podcast for 5 years have heard this story many times, but when I was 24, I was still entertaining the idea of being like a singer-songwriter type, right? Except I had crippling stage fright. So I, after seeing, this guy named Robin Hitchcock, perform at this little venue, I went and talked to him afterwards and said, you know, so thinking I was being different or whatever. So what advice do you have for a budding musician who has crippling stage fright? You know, and he just said, don't. And I was like, well, okay, thanks for crushing my dreams. But he was right, right? So like at that point, I had to decide, okay, is this something that I want to keep beating my head against the wall with, or do I want to find something that doesn't fill me with dread, that I enjoy equally? And, you know, that kind of took me a while to settle into what I wanted to do, but ended up coming right back to where I'm doing this now anyway. And I'll, you know, I have led you doing the podcast here, and I used to do, well, I still do on occasion, I guess, get up and participate in poetry readings and things like that. And, A lot of that stage fright. I ended up playing guitar with Glenn Tilbrook. And yeah, so it was just like these things that well, you know, what's important to me? Is it important to go ahead and have the experience and to do something that I care about and that I'll never get the chance to do again potentially? Or, you know, do I want to have my life filled with regrets at the end of it?
Absolutely. So,
it's these, and you were talking about free therapy, you know, it's to hear you kind of work through the experience of being in a completely alien land, essentially, you know, from climate on down to healthcare and food.
And we think we're so close culturally, and we're really not.
Not at all.
We're really not.
Really, not so much. But it's, you know, we speak the same language, sort of.
Sort of, yeah. That's what I realized as well.
We have a lot fewer U's in our words. One of the things that struck me about listening to Desert Diaries, though, is that, you know, for me, I learned very early on in the format. I tried, you know, writing something for myself to kind of go off of during the intro. And it always just sounded completely staged to me. Mm-hmm. Like I couldn't hear myself in it, which is why I ended up just, you know, kind of improvising on some just random thought or whatever. And I mean, you must write your stories ahead of time, but it doesn't sound prepared. It sounds very conversational to me. Was that something that you developed fairly early on, was a way to sound as though you were coming off the cuff, even though you had a written story?
I don't know. I'd not really thought about it. I suppose I wanted... I suppose I was a broadcaster for such a long time that when I first started out, I would write my links out. So I knew that I knew that I had things in my head that I'd worked hard, and it was almost like a stand-up comedy sketch almost. I would write this thing about, oh, I saw this band performing, and hilarious things that happened when I saw I was at this gig or whatever it was.
Sure.
And I would write it down. And then as time went on, I would just write key words down or write key phrases down because I knew I'd want to say certain lines. But I think just writing this out, I mean, I write it out. I physically write the essays, I suppose. They are essays, aren't they? Little storytelling essays each week.
Mm-hmm.
I do write them out, but they're quite gibberish. If I were to show you, someone did get in touch the other day and was like, you should make a book out of this. Have you got a manuscript? And this publisher wanted to see some of it, and it was nonsense. And I realized I'm not very good at typing, and I would just sit and kind of bash all this stuff out. Blah, blah, blah. And then I think I suppose first and foremost, I am writing it in my head. Mm-hmm. If you see what I mean, I'm not writing it as a piece of writing.
Sure.
I am thinking, imagining I'm telling it someone, but I'm writing it down. So I suppose the process is slightly different in that I'm telling my friend a story, but I happen to write it down. I'm not sitting and trying to write an essay.
It's almost more like a prompt for you to make sure you hit the points that you want to hit for that story.
Yeah. I wrote an article a couple of weeks ago about going on a road trip with my mum, who's dying of cancer.
Mm-hmm.
And I wrote it for a British newspaper. And the style of that is different because I wrote that because mm-hmm. I knew I was writing it to be in a newspaper. And I could read that as a sort of an essay, I suppose, but it's a much more reflective piece than me just yapping on that I think I do every week. I just yap on about stuff, you know, it's just like, rah. So, as I said, I hadn't really thought about it, but I suppose I'm imagining that I'm just telling somebody, but I write it down because I'm also a bit of a control freak in terms I don't want to kind of go off on tangents, and I want it, and I want it to be kind of quite succinct otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
It could wang on for ages. You know what? Yeah, blah.
Well, and so was that the main decision behind? Because none of the episodes are longer than 10 minutes.
No.
Was that just that you decided you wanted to do that very short format kind of thing?
Yeah, and also, I'm quite busy in mm-hmm. terms of, you know, I've got two kids. We've just moved to another country. My mum's sick. My dad's sick at the moment. It's been crazy since we've lived here, and I've kind of struggled with feeling settled and feeling okay quite a lot sure. of the times. And I think as much as I really love it, I really love it. You know, I've had some friends and I've been like, oh, this week's been really hard and I felt really lonely and I've done, and they're like, oh no, do you regret moving? And I'm like, no, no, not at all. But I'm aware that it's hard and I don't want to paint a great picture of, look at me, aren't I amazing? I followed my dreams. Because life isn't like that. It's not. And so I think I just kept them short because as well, I just wanted to kind of get the nub of stuff down. I've got a journal that I've nearly done for 5 years now. I'm on year five and it's called a one sentence a day journal. And I remember buying it in the Tenement Museum in New York City, which is like one of my favorite places in the world. And I bought this journal and I thought, oh, I can do that. I can do a sentence a day, because I'd had journals before and I'd started doing long, lofty essays each day about what had been going on. And you get to April and you're like, oh, suddenly you realize you're 6 days behind and you go, I can't catch up
because
it's going to take me 3 hours. So I'm not that, you know, I'm not the Samuel Pepys of the journal world. I'm the get the number of it down. So I suppose it was like that, that I thought that the way I'm going to keep this going is if I know that it's not only going to take me an hour.
Sure.
To write it, record it, edit it, upload it, because I've got quite a lot else going on. And if I suddenly go, it's going to take me through, I'll leave it. And then it's just never going to get done. So.
Well, then it loses its purpose for you.
Yeah. And I wanted to do it in the moment. I didn't want to kind of take notes and record it in 3 weeks' time. Mm-hmm. I didn't want to do that. I wanted to get how I was feeling and what had been going on and be really honest when things were really hard or horrible things happen, because again, I suppose the social media, Instagram filter world we live in,
right.
You know, that drives me crazy when I just think people who are just going, my life's amazing, look at my grid. And I'm like, but I know that that's not true. And I'm not saying that people should put their whole lives out there on social media. I don't think that at all. I suppose what I mean is don't feel the need to impress other people with your social posts.
It's not honest. No. There's absolutely no honesty behind it at all. I'm actually a big fan of somebody who is relatively candid that not everything is okay all the time. It just can't possibly be, you know, unless you live a completely vapid existence and don't really actually care about anything, which I suppose, you know, more power to you. Ignorance is bliss. But yeah, I think early on in the show you had a brief moment of saying that you promised you would make some longer episodes, and I was relieved that you didn't, because for one, it allowed me to binge the entire show in just a couple of days. But it also I like having done some of these long form podcasts and listened to a lot of long form podcasts, getting to hear something that it's almost like a palate cleanser, where you can also kind of hear, you know, just like a nice, you know, a friendly voice that you're familiar with or something, telling a brief, you know, snapshot of what's going on with their life, and then you're out and you're on to the next thing. So I've really enjoyed it so far. And you're nearly a year into it. At this point, how do you feel at all? Like the thing is that you've also had some unfortunate hiccups along the way with needing to you know, take, you know, go see your mom in Australia and the obvious awfulness with that. And then you even, you know, had some uncertainty about your dad being able to visit and all that. So it's not like you've had just like a year to just get settled either. But you know, I can't imagine. We talk about, and I think that you mentioned this briefly as well, the sheer landmass you have in front of you, you know, and the suburban sprawl, and you know, that's you're even in, you know, an area of Phoenix that has, you know, even more space between house than you know, anywhere in this area. You know, it's got to be just not even, you know, beyond all the physical things, just the culture shock alone has to be still have you reeling a bit.
The culture shock side of it is what gives me a kick, is what I just love. I just love, because when you step outside of your house to put your washing out, as I do, because I'm British and we put washing outside to dry because it's 70 degrees, why wouldn't you? But you know, if I step outside, and I mean, there was a hummingbird in my garden 2 days ago, and I just see that and I'm like, ah, and just silly things like hearing a fire truck go down the street with the horn blasting that would never happen in the UK. It's all these things that remind me, I did it. I did something crazy and I've actually done it. And the kind of little cultural bits are the things I really love. Saying truck, saying that to you, it's a fire engine in England.
Right.
And just finding words come out of my mouth that now are starting to feel natural. I mean, I feel weird saying words like process because it's process. And I feel, you know, but it would feel weird for me to say process. But when I say process, I feel other. And I suppose it all started when I kind of took some time out and went to New York and really felt so viscerally connected to being somewhere that even going into a shop and buying something was exciting. And I know that sounds ridiculous. It just is so stupid. But I thought, well, I'm a mum. I have to do boring things like buy toilet cleaner and washing up gloves and, you know, dog food. But actually going to a Sprouts or a Trader Joe's feels other, that makes the mundane feel exciting. And I feel really lucky for that. You know, walking these crazy summers that happen here, walking to put the trash out, as you would say here, at 10 o'clock at night and it's hot. Uh-huh. I'm like, ah, so stupid. And I just think if you can do something in your life that you get joy from the mundane, bloody do it, you know. And they find joy in different places. People might be listening to this going, I would never want to go and live in America. I would never want to go and live in Phoenix. That's okay. Sure. You know, you don't have to do what I want to do. Maybe you want to go and follow your football team around the country. I wouldn't be interested in that for 1 minute. I don't care. Mm-hmm. But I wouldn't say, well, that's stupid, because it's what you want to do, not what I want to do. And I think it's great we all want to do different things. Otherwise, how boring would that be?
Very true. A number of years ago at this point, I worked with a British expat, I guess. And we were, I had some conversation with him and his wife, and he, I'll never forget he would tell me a couple of things that always gave him a little bit of a kick as far as, the words that we say that mean something different for you. And the one that he always, where he would bring up frequently was fanny pack.
Yeah, I dated a Californian boy when I was 18, and I remember, I think, spitting beer out across the table when he went, can I have a fanny pack? I was like, what? Fanny? What? It's like a playground word. What? Yeah, and a very different meaning.
Yeah. Right, yes, yeah.
I love that.
That's pretty funny. Well, you know, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me. I really appreciate it.
It was really nice to meet you again.
Yeah, it's been a delight getting to know you through your podcast as well. And it's Sam Walker's Desert Diaries, and it's available everywhere, right? At least I found it pretty easily.
Well, good. I probably haven't done it properly, but as long as you found it, that's fine. Yeah, it's discoverable.
Yes, exactly it is. Well, thank you again.
Thanks.
All right, that's it. That's the show. Thank you to my guest, Sam Walker. Thank you, as always, for listening as well. Again, Sam's podcast is Desert Diaries. You can find that on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, all the platforms. Sam Walker's Desert Diaries. Check it out. For this show, if you don't already know, social media, Twitter, at @LTD_engagement, LTD engagement on Instagram. You can email ltd.engagement@gmail.com. I think that's right. Something like that. If you search for the show, you can find all the contact information. And if you are interested in supporting this and other Hoot and Waddle things, you can do so by going to patreon.com/hootandwaddle. And there are ways you can see to help out financially. I'm going to do something real quick. I have recently been uploading to the Limited Engagement Instagram some recordings of me playing some new music that I've been working on. This is not going to become a regular thing, but I am going to play a little bit of a piece that I've been working on because I'm really happy with it. And I'm going to play a little bit of a longer chunk than I can upload in a video that way. And it's I'm not you know, a riff guy like Marin, and I'm not gonna, like I said, do this every show. It's not a new bit, but I'm gonna play a little bit of this. And thanks for listening, and see you on down the road. This has been a Hoon Waddle production. If you enjoyed this podcast, why not check out one of our other fine podcasts available from hootandwaddle.com, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or any number of podcast apps. If you'd like to support Hoot and Waddle and get access to an exclusive member-only podcast, receive discounts on merch, and more, go to patreon.com/hootandwaddle.